This episode is brought to you by DailyDrip.com. DailyDrip makes it easy to keep up to date on your programming skills. You already know how much time it takes to find good resources and learn new languages. What if the hard part of that was already done for you? Sign up for DailyDrip and pick a topic that you want to learn about. Want to learn Swift? How about Elm? Or maybe you just want to brush up on your CSS and HTML. Every weekday, you'll get a short video or reading delivered to you via email. The best part is it only takes 5 minutes a day. We have a special coupon code just for Build Phase listeners. If you sign up using the coupon code BuildPhase, all one word, you'll save $9 on your first month, which means you can try out the Swift topic for free. Don't forget to use the coupon code BuildPhase to show support for our podcast. Make learning a part of your daily routine with DailyDrip.com. I'm going to turn on my video and we're going to see how this works.
All right. So far, so good.
Yeah, I...
First 5 seconds, no problem.
Clear, just smooth sailing from here on out. Clearly.
What could go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong?
Hey, everybody. This is Jack in Stockholm.
And this is Gordon in Austin.
And this is Build Phase.
I was telling Mark yesterday that I finally got our Wi-Fi sucks so bad in here. I feel bad for our listeners, but you haven't heard this yet. But our Wi-Fi sucks so bad at the office that I've had to buy Ethernet cables for all of the computers, including in this room. I had to buy an Ethernet cable and a Thunderbolt to Ethernet adapter.
Right.
So that I could. Did we talk about this? Did I talk about this last time?
We talked about that you're probably going to have to do this because you, like, right in that one spot is, like, targeted dead zone of the Wi-Fi. Like, just does not work.
So I did that, and shockingly, it fixed all of our problems. except that it takes, like, a minute for the DHCP lease or whatever to set up. So, like, so when you wake a computer up from sleep, it takes about a minute before you actually have an internet connection. Which is super frustrating.
That's weird. I started working at a new client the other day, and they have, for some reason, in their office, I haven't asked anybody, but for some reason, they don't have Wi-Fi. They just have wire connections. So when I got there and sat down, they had, like, ready to go, here's an Ethernet cable with a USB adapter. And I plugged it in, and it was just instantly on. There was just no delay whatsoever. And I was kind of surprised. I was expecting that's just probably going to have to, you know, activate some driver in some way. Like, I've never plugged in a USB Ethernet adapter on this laptop before, but it just worked instantaneously.
Right. It does kind of make me kind of pine for those old, like, wired internet connections were just so much more reliable than freaking Wi-Fi. And, you know. It is kind of nice, like, all of our, since we have Thunderbolt displays here, like, we just have a Ethernet cable plugged into the back of the Thunderbolt display. So when you're plugged in and you get Wi-Fi or you get internet through the display.
Right.
Which is nice. It's a little frustrating to have to plug it in specifically here. And I think we just bought two more cables and two more adapters so that we can do this in the phone booths as well, because the phone, the Wi-Fi is also dead zones in the phone booths. So, like, now we're going to, like, have a hook next to the door with, like, Ethernet cables and adapters. Yeah. So that you like, if you need to go take a call, you just take a cable off the hook. It's so dumb. It's like, what year is this? We're in a very large co-working space. How is this a problem?
Somehow we are regressing. Like, things are getting more difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty weird.
Anyway, what's new?
So, like I said, I just started a new client. It's so far so good. It's a very specific thing where I'm just kind of filling in for somebody. Like, they have a team member who is leaving and another team member is starting later with a gap in between. So I'm kind of bridging the previous guy and the next guy. So, but it's good. It's a chance for me to sort of try and insert some knowledge in there. They're mostly pretty junior people at this company, which is fine. Everyone's really nice and it's all going great. So it's good to sort of stick some new things in there. It's basically a company that they make it's a fairly simple sort of quiz app that did pretty well right off from the start. And so, like, at this point in time, they have millions and millions of users all across the world. And so what they really doubled down on in going forward with the app a few years ago was said, hey, let's make this localized, not just language-wise, but content-wise for countries all around the world.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's enormous in Germany and it's big in a lot of places. So it's pretty cool. So a lot of the company working there are not developers and not designers. They're people who are just dealing with like community management and the localized questions and answers and things for all the various countries.
Yep.
So extremely international crowd. Half the day I don't hear anyone speaking Swedish, but rather not even that much English either, but there's a lot of people speaking Russian and a little bit of French, a little bit of Spanish. It's cool.
That's cool.
Yep. So that's that for me. I started looking at Core Data again, which I had not done for a very long time, really, it seems like. And
are they using Core Data?
Yeah, they are a bit. Just for like within the game, you can chat with other players and your chat history is recorded in the app, is stored in Core Data. So like on their servers, they don't keep a full history. They actually toss that pretty quickly. But as long as you keep the app installed on your phone, it'll keep a history of all the chat you've had with a particular players that you've chatted with. And so you go back to a person, you can resume that conversation with them. And that's all stored in Core Data. And at first they were thinking, well, they're working on a new version. They said, well, we should ditch this and just use Realm instead. And I said, well, yeah, you could do that, but you're going to want to migrate all the old content from Core Data to Realm, which means you're going to build an app that has both Core Data and Realm in it.
Right.
So you can convert all users from Core Data to Realm. And what if someone has the app today and has the old one with Core Data only and doesn't launch the app again for 3 years? And you want them to still have their old conversations, right? So 3 years from now, you still have to have Core Data support in your app. And with always trying to migrate to Realm every user that starts up. So I said, why don't we just stick to Core Data? Because you have it there and it works. And so,
yeah.
So that's what we're doing. So it's basically the old app is going to be left behind in place of the new app, all written from scratch in C over the course of the past several months or year or something. What did I say? Written in C?
You did say written in C.
That's wrong. It's not written in C. It's written in Swift.
Okay. That makes a little more sense.
That would have been different. Yeah. No, written in Swift. And so I started looking around because I know iOS 10 has some new Core Data stuff.
Yeah, that's supposed
to be
good.
That deals with the top level handling of a stack.
Yeah.
And this app needs to support at least iOS 9 for a little while longer anyway. But I actually found that Big Nerd Ranch has a pretty complete, ready to go Core Data stack.
Yeah, they do. The older one.
Yeah. But it works nice. It's all up to date, and they even have all of their methods that they implement that are very similar to what are in iOS 10. They've marked those as deprecated for iOS 10. So nice. If you're building with the iOS 10 SDK, it'll actually say, hey, don't use this. Use the built-in stuff instead.
Nice.
But despite that, they have more things they've added too. So there's additional stuff that you can also use. So
this stuff on their app, it's not stuff that can be recreated from the server at all? It only lives on the device?
Right, because some of the chat history, like the server retains the most recent conversations you've had with a player, but not all of it, because they decided they didn't want to do that. Like it's not a chat application, it's a game application. But they decided a long time ago to just store on the app what the app can store.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, I mean, obviously this would have been a much easier solution had they kept the server as like the source of truth on this, because you could just do a very simple, like, has this user migrated to Realm yet thing, where you basically don't include Core Data, blow away the Core Data thing, and then re-pull the entire history. And so, like, the very first time they open the app with the new architecture, it would take a minute to like
and pull that in. Yeah.
You know, upgrading your database is the thing you would put on the screen with a spinner. And people go like, what does that mean?
Think of all the support emails they would get.
For what?
Your app is broken. It just says updating the
I mean, if it just didn't stop, sure. But hopefully it would stop within a reasonable amount of time. Anyway.
But you know, there'd be somebody who would have an incredibly huge chat in there, right? They're doing quizzes with their friend all day long every day and chatting about it, and they've got 10 million records in there or something. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's not what they have since they're not retaining all that. So
yeah, I was just curious.
It's interesting because I think you and I are used to working in from that end of things in that world where if you're going to have something you're going to save, obviously you save it on the server.
Right. I mean, how many times did we use Core Data in all the projects? Like in all the projects that I've been on, I think I've used Core Data once.
Yeah, ThoughtBot, I've used it once or twice only.
Right. I honestly think that that's a side effect of really trying to shoot for MVP. Because I honestly think that most apps can get, like, Core Data is great for either if you don't have a backend, which we just generally, for whatever reason, our projects didn't have backends.
Right.
If you don't have a backend to store data, or if you need, like, long-term persistence for either, like, offline access or for performance. So, like, if you need it, you know what I mean? Like, where you don't want to pull every single tweet that the user has ever tweeted.
Right.
Probably makes sense to batch a bunch of that like and store it on the device. And so, but with MVP, you know, at least the way we've constantly approached MVP, that kind of stuff is always secondary and can always be iterated towards instead of like built out initially.
Yeah, that's always thought of as a future optimization. Like in the future, when we have a lot of users and a lot of content, then we figure out how to cache it locally.
Right. And I think that's a reasonable thing, but it's an interesting side effect that it's like there are like a lot of parts of iOS development that I think I haven't touched in a while just because we just never get to that point where we need to deal with it. You know what I mean? Core Data being one of those things.
Right. Because I did have one ThoughtBot project that I was working on for several months where I was using Core Data, and that was essentially, like you say, it was not, there was really not a backend involved, and it was a Mac app, and I was using it basically as the storage format for the document that was being created in the app, which is what Core Data was really kind of meant for in the first place. And for that, it still works great. You know, I think a lot of the complaints people have about Core Data come from the fact that people are, I wouldn't say misusing it, but they're using it in a way that was not the original use case. It was never meant to be a wrapper around SQLite.
Right.
You know, it was never meant to be, let's stick a million records in a table.
Right.
You know, it's more meant to be, here's a way to deal with document storage in a different way. You can sort of have a document that you can store pieces of it and kind of deal with it bits at a time rather than having a giant object graph that you load in the whole thing and unpack it all at once and then serialize the whole thing and pack it down. You can sort of have a document that is a living object graph on your disk in kind of a database. And for that, I think Core Data is still pretty great. I think I would love it if Apple would do something that is not Core Data, but that is more along the lines of something like Realm that is really meant to be, here is a persistence layer for a whole bunch of objects. You can just dump them in there. Which we could do right now with SQLite, but you kind of have to write your own wrappers around that.
Right.
So that's what's going on with me in terms of my projects and stuff. The other thing that I've been thinking about and following a lot, which I'm sure you have too, is the thing with the new MacBook Pros. And everyone's kind of wringing their hands about, Apple know what developers need anymore? Right. Why do they hate us? And da 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 da.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been unfollowing a lot of people on Twitter. Like a lot of people.
I just feel like, you know, it's the same mindset that, you know, and Apple has been doing this for at least 20 years, you know. Like the first big thing that I remember, and there are probably more before this, but it was like when they released the iMac without floppy drives, and everybody lost their minds. Like, oh my God, are you serious? A computer in 1997 without a floppy drive? What are you thinking? And it's like, well, as it turns out, yeah, people were kind of done with that technology. Mm-hmm. And likewise now, the thing is like, okay, it doesn't have an HDMI port. I guess I use that sometimes, but I also can just use a display port. And I guess, you know, within a short amount of time, all the conference rooms I step into will have that little adapter thingy for USB-C on the table, along with the current one that is the DisplayPort adapter. You know, it's like, this is just going to become a common piece of stuff lying around. Yep. And similarly, like the SD card slot, that's nice when I need to use it, but man, I don't know when is the last time I stuck anything in my SD card slot. It may not even be on this laptop. It may be on the one I had prior to this. I just don't know.
Yeah. I am, as we're having this conversation, I'm kind of like looking at the things plugged into my laptop right now. And I do have, like I said, like I already have one dongle that's going from Ethernet to Thunderbolt. I've got my power plugged in on this side. And then over here on this side, I've got the USB plugged in for the preamp, right? Mm. My audio interface. And then back on this side, I have my headphone jack. And I do use the SD card slot for photography. Like, you know, my camera takes SD cards, so I can just, it's very nice to be able to pop it out of the camera, pop it in directly into my Mac. But I don't care that much. Yeah. I'd find a way around all of those things, right? Like, you know, the headphone jack is still there, right?
Yeah, the headphone jack is still there.
So who cares?
Because it has four USB-C ports. And yeah,
it has four USB-C ports.
I saw on Amazon, I think it was like a four-port USB hub thing that plugs into USB-C.
Right.
That cost $10 or something.
Right.
And it's like...
One of the things I really like about the move to just having four USB-C ports is that the whole thing where, like, you don't need a dedicated power port. Any of those four will act as power now, which is, like, for me, that is, like, a constant frustration for me because I'm constantly... It's like the USB problem. You know how, like, the USB 1 and 2 and 3, but how it's, like, you know, you have to try it three times before you get it the right way, like, every single time. I'm... always, without fail, on the wrong side of my whatever plug I have, like including right now.
Right.
The cable is going from over here on behind my right-hand shoulder around and under the desk and then up and then looping back around to the left-hand side of my laptop. Yep. That's annoying to me. And like I have to do that a lot, right? Where I'm constantly like wrapping the cable around myself because the plug is off to my right somewhere.
Yep.
It just seems like a common thing, and so to be able to say, like, oh, well, I can just plug it into this port now on the right-hand side, and now I don't have that problem anymore is, like, very nice.
Right. Yeah, same thing here. I've also got, right now, also have my power cord snaking across to the other side of the desk.
What is that? How does that happen? How does it happen? Like, I'm just thinking back at my house. Every time I'm sitting on the couch, the plug is to the right of me. If I'm sitting on my bed, the plug is to the right of me. Everywhere I go in my life. Oh, I think the only time that it ever is ever on the right, the correct side is if I'm recording podcasts at my house and then I'm sitting at, like on my island in my kitchen and then I have, then it's on the correct side. But every other time, the wrong side, without fail.
Oh, man.
I don't know. I feel like you and I have had our recording times scheduled after these announcements a lot.
Yeah, we've had a couple of these, yeah.
Where we have to talk about, like, the negativity in the community and stuff, but it's so frustrating to me.
Yeah, and you know, people seem to be upset that, well, this isn't using the new chipset from Intel, whatever it's called. They all have weird names. I don't know. I'm not a chipset person. I don't care. But, like, sure, they could be using a newer chipset with slightly faster RAM access and a slightly faster CPU, but that's not what you're going to notice because all you're noticing when you're waiting for your computer is you're waiting for things on the internet.
Yep.
Like, almost everybody. Sure, there are people I know who are doing high-end. If you're doing music and video and even photography stuff, applications, that is stuff to wait for. If you can squeeze that, you know, get stuff 20% faster, that's great. But for most people, that's not happening.
We could get compile time down. Like, there's some things that just take forever to compile, you know what I mean? But it's like, you know.
It's not that much. Like, I would like it to be faster. And the point is that if you've got an older laptop, you know, older,
Right.
You know, my laptop is 3 years old, my current one, and the new ones are, you know, marginally faster than that. Mm-hmm. And if the new upgrade is not enough of an upgrade for you speed-wise, then don't buy it. Use the one you already had, because it's probably still fine. You know, it's like...
Yeah. My favorite line from people is, in the same breath, is like, why would I buy this new one? My old one is just fine, and it's the same speed. It's like, okay, mm-hmm. let's unpack that real quick. One, if your old one's fine, why are you looking at a new laptop? You don't need one, clearly. Like, that's not, you know what I mean?
Right, like, it's just like some sort of compulsive
you will just want to buy it.
Like,
right.
I just need a new one.
Right, and you don't. You like, I promise you, nothing bad is going to happen to you if you don't buy a new laptop. But then also, like, if your old one is fine in terms of speed and memory and stuff, and the new one is exactly like your old one with, like, new touch bar, better ports, better, faster, right. Like, the ports are crazy better, like, so much better than what we have now. So how is that not an upgrade? Like, I don't understand how that math works out to you, that it isn't an upgrade because it's the same as my current one, but better.
Right.
Right?
Like, they're upgrading things that people don't see that they want.
I'll be honest. I don't know what to make of the touch bar. I don't at all.
No.
Part of that is that, like, I am a Vim user, and so I am very attached to that escape key.
Right.
And so the idea of a software escape key does not thrill me. And then I also don't look at the keyboard when I'm typing. I'm a touch. I try to be do touch typing,
right,
as much as possible. So some of this stuff on the touch bar I might not use, but at the same time, I don't use the function keys now. So
yeah, right. Yeah, I think that, like, it might be that this gives us some new use cases we haven't thought about, and it's also, I think it's important to realize this thing is going to light up. It's going to be brighter than the keys right. around it. So you should be able to, if it is any kind of control, it is sort of like a slider or whatever, or even if it is just buttons. Those things right. are going to be brighter than the keys, so you won't need to, like, I think the way you'll perceive those visually will be different than the way you perceive a normal key, because it's going to be, like, you won't need to look at it as much as you're looking at normal keys.
I did have the thought that if I could take the stuff that's in my menu bar right now that I actually care about, which is basically mm-hmm. just the time and my battery percentage, and have those kind of omnipresent on my touch bar, mm-hmm. I would hide the menu bar full time, because you can do that in OS and Mac OS for the past few releases.
I didn't know that. I mean, now you can go full screen all the apps, but
no, I'm trying to figure out where it is. It's in the general settings, right under use dark menu bar and dock. You can say automatically hide and show the menu bar, where it just always hides the menu bar. It always has that full screen behavior where, like, the menu bar is hidden until you mouse over it. And I keep that off because I like to see the time and the battery percentage. But yeah. if I could have those on the touch bar, I would hide the crap out. Like, everything would basically be fake full screen all the time for me. I would turn that on immediately.
I didn't know that was a thing. That's cool.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, about the escape key, there's actually a solution for that I think most people don't know about. So the standard US keyboard on the Mac has a certain number of keys, 64 or something like that. There is something called the International English Keyboard, which has one more key. And so basically what happens is the key that is to the left of one on your US keyboard, which is like backtick, that moves down to the left shift key, left of the Z, is split in two. So on my keyboard, I have right next to the Z, just left of the Z is where I have the back tick, and left of that is the shift. And so the additional key is the one to the left of the one, which used to be where back tick is on US. On International English, that is like the paragraph symbol. It's like the stupidest key in the world that no one needs. And it's right below where escape normally is. So you can you can use the one of the things that lets you make your own key maps. Like, there's an app called Ukulele that does it.
Yeah.
So you can map that to be escape. That is my plan. I haven't done it yet,
But yeah. I should do it now anyway, because I often hit that by mistake.
That's
instead of escape.
That's exactly what I was going
to
say.
And that is a key that I never, ever, like, I never want to type that paragraph symbol. Never, ever in my life. So
What a weird key.
So that's a tip. So so instead of buying the US keyboard, buy the International English, and you get one more key, which you can then map to escape.
The other thing that I've seen people doing is that there's actually a synonym for escape in Vim, where if you hit control left square bracket, that sends the exact same signal as escape. So you could just send that instead. The other thing you can do is a lot of people I've seen map JJ to escape. So that in Vim, you just hit JJ and that does escape for you, which slows down your movement keys a little bit, like if you're using J and K, but you shouldn't be using J and K for movement anyway. You should be using other things. So I've had this thought that, like, I would be frustrated by the lack of an escape key, but one, there are three reasonable alternatives. And two, I would get over it. Like, and then, like, even then, most of my typing I do on my physical keyboard, you know, at my desk. I have, like, a big mechanical keyboard. So if I'm on my mechanical keyboard, who cares, right? At that point, I'm just smashing my escape key and it's sending the right symbol.
Right. Whatever. Yeah, same for me. Most of my work, I'm using a different keyboard anyway. It doesn't matter. So, because I do have one of these that is on order, and my plan for escape is to do the custom mapping, get rid of that dumb paragraph key once and for all, remap that to escape. Uh-huh. And then I should be all set.
I'm excited to hear what you think about it.
Yeah, I will let you know. I guess the biggest question mark is, of course, the touch bar and, like, what the use of that is going to be and how it works. I haven't really looked at it yet. I haven't looked at the SDK and stuff. It requires Sierra, and I haven't upgraded yet. I'm busy. And soon I'll have a new machine that's already got Sierra on it, so what the hell.
Right. Yeah, I actually just finally installed Xcode 8.1 yesterday, so I could do some work. I talked about it with Mark yesterday. I don't want to go too much into it. Actually, I actually solved the problem. Mark and I talked yesterday, like I said, and I was running into a problem that did turn out to be a Swift bug. So I fixed the bug on Argo's side, and there's been a bug open. It's been a crazy 24 hours. There's been a bug opened on Jira to track the actual underlying Swift bug. But it's like, we talked about this before, right? About how, like, Swift is that one place where I still run into things, and my immediate reaction isn't, oh, I did something wrong. My immediate reaction is, oh God, is this a Swift bug? And he's like, haha, I was right this time though. like this changed.
Sometimes it actually
and it
is,
broke,
yeah.
And it was a Swift bug. And so it was, like, very vindicating.
Yeah, I saw you posted something the other day, but I didn't delve into it, but I saw that you had something you were chasing down.
Yeah, the gist, as far as I understand it, is that when they changed the way numbers are bridged, they changed something about the way numbers are bridged from Objective-C to Swift. And those kind of casts, like, you used to be able to do any NS number and then just say, like, as float, right? And it would basically be the same as doing dot float value on the NS number. And so we were using that in Argo. We found it more aesthetically pleasing to do that than to have the methods. So we just did that. And two of those broke. Uint and float just stopped working like that. Like, it was actually, but it was throwing an exe bad access. So I pinged Joe Groff about it, and I was like, hey, this seems like a side effect of this thing. And he was like, yeah. He's like, actually, we probably should just disallow that in general. So after talking to him, I went through and changed all of those casts to be dot float value, dot double value, etc.
Right.
And then Adam Sharp, coworker in New York, was able to, on the pull request, he kind of reduced it down to some very simple use cases or very simple test cases that you can see, like, here's exactly what's causing this. So that is merged into Argo. I'm waiting for one more thing, and then I want to ship a new version of Argo on Friday, I think, that will include that fix, which is going to be like Xcode 8.1/ Swift 3.0.1 support, and which is basically a bug fix. It will also include we removed optional, a static method optional, which basically marks a decoding operation as failable, like that it's fine for this to fail.
Right.
We had removed that because we didn't think it was useful anymore. We're re-adding it in a much more simplified way where it's basically just forces it to succeed. And then Swift Package Manager support I also added. So want to get that out.
So I remember using with the operator, there were operators that had a question mark.
Yeah, so it's the thing that underlies that.
Okay.
I don't know if we removed it or if we just made it private.
Hmm.
But the gist is that the former behavior of that static.optional method was fairly confusing. It actually had logic involved. Depending on what kind of failure it was, it would either fail or not fail. And we simplified. It was confusing. We had to think through it every time to kind of reason about how it worked. And it was just complex. And so what we did instead is we just simplified the whole thing so that if you do some like parsing operation, you get this decoded T.
Mm-hmm.
If you just call optional on it, it will just turn it into decoded optional T, where it always succeeds. Like it cannot, that will never fail, right? And it's like just a much more simple way of saying like, hey, this is optional, right? Not this is optional, but because I use the framework enough or because I wrote the framework, I understand that it is optional under these specific circumstances. It's like none of that. It's just optional, period.
Okay. Okay.
So it just simplifies it a lot. And once we kind of said it was like, yeah, of course that's how this should work. It's like this weird thing where we put it back the way it was and then it was like, wait a minute, weren't we going down this road? Like this has just causes so many problems. Why the hell don't we just do it this simple way? It's very funny.
Right.
So, you know, it's a maintenance release. Essentially, it's going to be like 4.0.1 or maybe 4. I might do it as 4.1 because it's re-adding some stuff that was gone. But and I guess Swift Package Manager support is technically a new feature.
And how is that working? Because last time I heard you talking about that, you were having some frustrations around it.
Yeah, building is fine.
Hmm.
It builds fine. The thing I was waiting for Argo, the thing that I couldn't do, I couldn't add Swift Package Manager support to Argo before we released Runes was the issue. Mm-hmm. Runes had to have a tagged release with Swift Package Manager support because it's a dependency of Argo. So now that Runes is released, Runes 4.0 is released, Argo can now declare Runes as a dependency in the package file, and it just builds. It took a little bit of project reorganization, which was like not a big deal. Basically, I just nested everything under a sources directory.
Mm-hmm.
But so building is done. It works. It took about 5 minutes once I moved everything and then rehooked up the sources in Xcode. It's back to normal.
Okay, cool.
The only problem is you still can't test with Swift, like the Swift test. You know, the testing support that comes in Swift Package Manager, because you still can't declare test dependencies with Swift Package Manager. In fact, after the 3.0.1 release, I guess, some point recently, they actually just removed it altogether because there used to be like a test dependencies key you could pass to the package to say like, and here are my test dependencies. And that was incredibly frustrating because it absolutely just ignores it. Like at some point that stuff got disconnected, and so I'd sit there adding it and I'm just going like, I don't understand, this doesn't work. And then I look in the source code and I'm going like, how does this even compile? I can't find this string test dependencies anywhere in the freaking project. And it's because they removed it at some point in the past. And so what I really need to do is I need to open a thread on Swift build dev about this and kind of get some momentum behind it, because once Swift test works, I am absolutely going to start looking at like, okay, CI now runs Swift test, not Xcode build test, and like all my local stuff, Swift test, like all of that stuff is going to move over to Swift test. I'll keep the projects around because I need them for Carthage support, but again, I think that Carthage could, in theory, move away from requiring projects. And if it's a Swift package, it could also then just generate an Xcode project for it to build.
Right.
So
yeah, that seems reasonable.
Yeah, I'm itching to get that done.
Yeah. So what exactly is missing? Like, you can't specify test dependencies. You can't specify dependencies that you need only for the test. You don't need for other things. Is that
right,
what you're saying?
Okay. Right. So, for example, in Runes, we use SwiftCheck as like the testing framework. And SwiftCheck is an external dependency. I do not want to declare that as a dependency of Runes. That would be crazy. So what I want to do is just declare it as a test-only dependency so that it's only included in the Runes tests target. Mm-hmm. Ditto, similarly for Argo. Argo is a little more complicated, but for Argo, I need to be able to declare Curry as a test dependency, not as a hard dependency, because it isn't a hard dependency, and I want to continue to make that clear.
Okay.
And so I want to be able to add Curry as a test dependency. And then there's also this thing where we're using NS Bundle a lot in Argo's test suite.
Really?
Yeah, for all the JSON stuff. So Argo's tests depend on a lot of JSON fixtures, right?
Right.
Makes sense. It's a JSON parsing framework. We parse JSON as a part of our tests. So we use NS Bundle a lot for pulling out those fixture files. I'm not entirely sure how that would work with Swift test. I think what I might have to do is remove the tests entirely from the Xcode project and instead use some like hard file lookup kind of stuff. Like literally look for the file, you know, the JSON file at this path, like use relative path stuff to try to pull it out, I think. But I'm not positive that any of that, since I haven't been able to get past the test dependency stuff, I can't even start to think about the fixture stuff.
Like that's probably workable either through, like, you can find out when you run the tests, like, what working directory am I in when this runs.
That's my hope. Yeah.
And because if I'm not, that it may be that it puts you in some weird crazy location that is, like, you know, where your build products are or something like that. But even in that case, there's probably going to be an environment variable of some kind that names where the source directory is or something. There's probably a way to do that.
Yeah, I'm pretty optimistic that I can make that work, even if it's ugly. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But the no test dependency thing is such a showstopper that there's not much for me to do beyond, you know, Runes and Argo both have their tests set up to work with, like, they're in the right place. You know what I mean? The folder structure is correct for a Swift test, but you can't actually run Swift test with either of them. The tests fail immediately.
Okay.
So that's where that's at.
Nuts.
But now that Argo has, where once we ship Argo with Swift Package Manager support, we can do that thing that I was saying before, where we submit it to the IBM Swift Package repo thing, and then we could, in theory, have one of those Swift Playground, like online Swift Playgrounds with Argo already imported, because Curry is up there too. So we could already have, and Runes, I think, is up there. I don't actually know that any of these things are up there, but in theory, we have Argo, Runes, and Curry all up there, and we have a live workspace that has all three of those imported, and we could just put a link in the README, and everything would be great.
Yeah, that'd be cool. To let people sort of try it out.
Yeah, I would use it constantly, because every time, like yesterday, last night, and this today, I was answering questions in Argo issues, and I was just like typing stuff out in GitHub because I didn't have Xcode installed. So I was like just typing crap out in GitHub going like, I don't know. This type checks in my brain, but I don't know that it really type checks in real life. So it's probably pretty close. Yeah, and that's just not a good way. It would have been so much easier for me to like pop open a thing and like actually write it out and then make sure it compiles and then just send them a link to the working, actually like working thing.
Yeah, I know that I've done a lot of that in my day. Like just like writing stuff in emails or on forums, whatever, saying, this seems like it's probably the solution.
I'm just
writing this in mail, so I haven't tried this, but this is probably it. And it's really gratifying. Sometimes people will write back like, hey, that was exactly it. Thanks.
Oh, yeah. If I can do that, especially with Argo, where it's like so type dependent, like anytime I'm able to do that, where it's like, oh, I copied that in there, it worked perfectly. It's like, that is incredible. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I need to take a second and appreciate that for a minute, because like, I just nailed that. It feels like, you know, some hard puzzle that, you know, those people that solve puzzles that do like big, like 1,000-piece puzzles, but they do them upside down. What? Where you can't see the picture. Have you not seen that?
No.
There are people that do puzzles, but they don't do the puzzles where you can see the photo. They do the puzzles with all the pieces face down. And it's like, that's what it feels like sometimes when I nail one of these Argo questions without a compiler.
Wow. Yeah.
You should look that up. It's really impressive.
Upside down puzzle solving. That's
pretty good. You should look it up.
Yeah, that is like some kinds of programming. Totally.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of Argo, you know we had to talk about this.
Yeah.
What's the latest scoop on the Swift JSON shootout? We were talking about this a bit.
Kind of nothing.
Okay.
So I almost don't want to bring attention to it. But so someone wrote a GitHub, I don't know if you call it an article or what you call it, but there's a GitHub repo where someone did like, they wanted to evaluate a bunch of different JSON parsing libraries. And so they wrote like this pretty basic little app that parses a JSON file into models. And they used all these different JSON parsing libraries to do it. And then I think did benchmarks on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the end result was that they actually didn't even really fully evaluate Argo. Argo has like a footnote in there somewhere where it's like, what about Argo? And they said basically that it was like 15 times slower than the next slowest.
Right.
Or 15 times slower than the fastest, or 15 times slower than
something like that.
Like the number 15 times, like they said that it was by far like the slowest JSON parsing framework out there. And then they also said some stuff like that it was bloated because it requires curry and runes as extra dependencies. And they also said that they had to mangle their model in order to get it to work.
Right. Which doesn't seem right. Cause I looked at the model and like, I remember from, you know, back in the old days when Argo was new and there was that limitation, a very, you know, you couldn't have more than like a dozen things or whatever.
Right.
But this is not even that, like their model only had 8 or 9 things in it.
Right.
So like that can't have been correct. But then again, I haven't tried to look to see what the issue was. I mean, I kind of meant to take a look at it, but I haven't. And then kind of the weird assertion that something is heavy because it contains runes. Like runes is not big.
Yeah, thank you. Neither is Argo, for what it's worth. Argo is under 400 lines of code. The whole thing, including white space and comment and documentation. So it's like it's very hard for me to get behind, like, so, and the JSON file that they were parsing is 7 megabytes. So any performance benchmark at 7 megabytes of a JSON file just feels disingenuous. Because if you're pulling a 7 megabyte JSON file over the wire,
That's pretty unusual.
Like, how big is our big data JSON file?
So, like, I guess the one thing that I can think of that could be, that can make a substantial difference in how not just Argo, but how any JSON framework could do that more quickly or more slowly would be in terms of if you are delving down into structures and the result of unpacking that is never retained anywhere. And so every time you delve down into it, you have to sort of dig through it again.
Yeah.
Which may be what's going on.
So a few things. I want to get to that. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this.
No.
So a few things. One, we have a test that tests like just basically a performance test that says like, let's test like parse the biggest JSON file, like bigger than any JSON file we reasonably make. We made it huge in order to be able to see any difference at all. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like all this stuff is so fast that you need to get to these gigantic JSON files in order to see any real difference that you're making in terms of benchmarking.
Yeah.
Our big data JSON, bigdata.json, which is, oh man, this is going to, this might crash my computer. Bigdata.json is, let me count the zeros, 330,000 lines long.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a big JSON file.
Yeah, you will seldom download anything that size from the web.
If you do, you've made a huge mistake. Bigdata.json is only 5.3 megabytes, and he's using a 7 megabyte JSON file as their benchmark. It's like, okay, I mean, that's not, we wouldn't put our numbers for decoding bigdata.json out as our realistic performance numbers,
right?
Because you shouldn't be touching that size.
Yeah,
you know?
That's not really the use case.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is, like I said, like the idea that Argo is bloated is so just misinformed.
Hmm.
It's just a complete misunderstanding about how our code is structured and a complete misunderstanding of what any of these libraries are doing. Like all three right. of these libraries are so small and so focused. That's why we made them that way, right? It's like, yes, it's two extra dynamic libraries that you have to pull in, but I think it's a reasonable trade-off to make, and I don't think it makes our libraries bloated. In fact, I think it's the opposite. I think that our libraries
exactly.
are slimmer because of the fact that we've broken them up.
Right. Like, I think that, ironically, the author of this article would have preferred to see that Argo just had runes right. and curry right inside of it, and would have considered that to be less bloated.
Right.
When but clearly, that's actually the opposite.
It's the it would have been the wrong move from a product standpoint. Right.
And right.
from a good citizen of the community, that would have been the wrong. Like, can you imagine if we just shipped 20 implementations of curry and all these weird things inside, just directly inside Argo? It's like we wouldn't be compatible with so many other things at that point. We would conflict all the freaking time.
Right.
And we would force stuff on our users that we just don't want to force on our users.
And I think this is the thing where people, at a certain stage, people expect to see or want to see kind of one mega framework that incorporates all the pieces of itself and is just like, pretend that is just one thing, right? And
right.
like, I can use this one thing and not think about that, okay, behind this simple interface, you know, there's a huge ton of stuff that's all sucked down there into the same module in the same namespace. And I think about, you know, something like Ruby on Rails, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which has gone through the journey of being this huge monolithic thing, and over a lot of pain over years, has been somewhat pulled apart. So you can use just the core of it. You can sort of choose parts of it because people realize over time, okay, having one giant framework of everything is not really what you want for modularity's sake. You actually want to not have that.
And then that's amplified if you look at the way Phoenix works. But like Phoenix is very much kind of a reimagining of Rails.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the very specific things that they did was they pulled it apart even more, where like everything is decoupled. So you can like update the entire rendering engine aside from any of the rest of the app, right? So you can like, if you can fix a bug in the rendering engine, in the HTML engine, and just use a newer version of that, or use an older version of that and upgrade everything else. So like that level of modularity, to me, it's clearly a better solution than kind of massive mono frameworks.
Right.
All that to say that I have no illusions at all about the fact that there's definitely performance tuning that we could do and probably should do in Argo. I have no problem in being the slowest or one of the slowest JSON parsing frameworks out there if the numbers are presented realistically, because I think realistically, these are numbers that you're not going to notice, that you may hit performance issues, but the performance issues are almost always going to be around Swift because we're doing so little. And that there are almost certainly places that we could use. We've had a couple, not false starts, but like Tony specifically has done a couple like explorations into trying to do some stuff asynchronously to speed things up, and there's actually an open pull request that we're trying to figure out what to do with right now that's like has a pretty significant speed increase, but it's always like, well, this is going to sacrifice some of the purity of what we have right now, and if this is solving a real problem, then that's fine. And we've done that stuff, right? We've done things where it's like we went through and removed the use of reduce basically from the framework entirely because reduce was so slow that people were saying ridiculous performance hits just by us using reduce.
Right.
On real data, like on real, not gigantic, not obscenely large data. That's where a lot of these big data JSON parsing tests came from, was like, okay, well, how bad is this really? And we were able to seriously increase it to the point where like, I don't know. I'm more interested in real world benchmarks than I am fictional 7 megabyte benchmarks. Mm-hmm. And I find it frustrating. and disingenuous to have that kind of information presented in that specific way where, like, the author clearly didn't really understand how Argo is supposed to work, how Argo does work, or why it made the decisions that it makes. Like, right. Presenting as if it's an all-or-nothing thing, it just feels... I want to use the word unfair, but that feels a little crybaby to me. You know what I mean? It's not that it's unfair. It is...
It's somewhat uninformed.
Yeah. And then we end up getting issues on Argo that are like, hey, what do you think about this? This person says you're the worst JSON parsing framework. It's like, well, that sucks. Like, how do you think I feel about that? That doesn't feel great at all. Thanks for bringing it up.
Wait, do you like to make issues about that?
There was one issue, and that's not how it was worded. Okay. It was worded as, let me pull it up so I actually get it right. The title was Worst Performing JSON Mapping Framework. It was like, hi guys, any comments on these benchmarks? And is a link to that JSON shootout, which now that I have open, I will put in the thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, like you say, it's, you know, again, similar to what I was saying also about whether you have a 2.7 or 2.9 megahertz CPU. Like, these are things that are not going to be what you're noticing as a problem in the real world, because you're not going to have a 7 megabyte JSON file.
Right.
I hope, you know, again, like you said, if you are, then you're probably doing something wrong. But then again, we're in a world where, what was it? I saw something the other day where some like typical article page on CNET or something was 160 megabytes with all like the images and crap it downloaded. We as a profession, if I include everyone who is producing web content or whatever, are apparently terrible at thinking about, hey, maybe we shouldn't send down the equivalent of half of a CD-ROM full of stuff when someone clicks a link.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think people who are doing reasonable application development will try to make it so that they are not sucking down 7 megs at a time in a single request and then wading through all of it.
Yep. I don't know. So I guess like long term, I would love for help on this kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Yep. I would absolutely love for performance help. If people actually want it, like if people want to get involved with Argo, like that is a very clear thing for us to work on, right? Is our object specifically, you know, just the mapping of objects. And yes, it's almost certainly related to what you mentioned of that, like we parse things multiple times. Like if you dig through a tree, like here's a pretty common example, right? If you have a root key, if you pull the root key out and then pass the JSON into the decoder or the parser into the decode method, then we just will decode everything from that point on, right? Obviously, because that's what you've handed us. But if you use the array syntax to pull out that root key for each property, well, then we're decoding that root key for each property.
Right.
You're adding one more decode step by not pulling that out earlier, right?
Right. And this is something where it seems to me that if Swift suddenly got better at understanding when a function was pure, then it could do things like Haskell, I think, can do, where it can actually cache the result of, okay, I know that I've called this function already before with the exact same parameters, so I know the result. So I can just keep this result, and if next time these come in the same way, I'm just going to return that thing I already have. Yeah. Like, if Swift suddenly acquired that ability, like, it would just, you know, it would make Argo suddenly 1,000 times faster or whatever, right? Because it would, in those cases, it would never have to redo that stuff again. But right now, as it is, it would be kind of a pain in the ass to do that ourselves, I guess. And
yeah, there's something there, but I just can't see it, right?
Yeah.
And like I said, like, we've had attempts down that road, but nothing, we haven't taken it far enough. And maybe, you know, maybe that's something that I'll take a stab at some point. But I, you know, the other thing is just how much time I have. Like, you know, it's just there's so much stuff going on and there's so many other things. And again, I don't necessarily, like, I don't hear a lot about this being a real issue in real life for people. What I do hear is that this is an issue when people are parsing unrealistically large JSON files. We don't get performance, not anymore. I mean, there was a big performance thread, and we kind of got it to a reasonable place, and I haven't heard anything since then.
Right.
So my point being that there are just other things that end up grabbing my attention or feeling more important, like, for example, shipping Swift Package Manager support or fixing mm-hmm. this bug as that, you know, from the Swift changes. Like, those are things that I feel like I need to fix now. I don't feel that same way about performance.
Right.
Even though I know that it's like a thing that I would like to improve at some point.
Yeah, you always want to get make it better, but at some point, if this is good enough that it works in the real world, and it is, and it does, then there's not much to complain about.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's way longer than I wanted to spend talking about.
Yeah, but you know, I had to bring it up.
I know you did.
But yeah, I think that it's nothing to worry about. You know, it would be nice, but again, it's, you know, like I said, it's not a real world concern.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone is more performance minded than I am, which doesn't take a whole lot because I'm not the most performance conscious person on the face of the planet. Mm. You know, I will help walk through any of the Argo stuff that you don't understand if this is something that you're interested in taking on, is I guess right. What I would say. Like, I understand that Argo isn't the easiest framework to dive into and just start working on, but I am more than willing to assist as much as I can anyone with a more performance minded bent that wants to try to solve this to some extent.
Right. Cool.
Anyway, all right.
Should we wrap this up?
Yeah. Yeah. I got to go to the gym, pick up heavy things.
Yeah. Me too. No, not really.
And then I got to watch the World Series. You watching the World Series? What time does it start there? 1 a.m. 2 a.m.
Yeah. No, I'm not watching it. It's super late. And I think like this is not an event that Swedish media is covering. I have no idea how I would watch it. The Super Bowl is broadcast here.
Yeah.
The World Series, well, it might be. I have like 20 sports channels on my cable system. It probably is somewhere, actually, now I think about it.
108 years, man. That's a long time.
It's a long time. There's some history there.
There's a lot of history there. One last thing is that there are some African-American players on the Cubs, and they're actually the first black players to ever play in the World Series for the Cubs, because the last time the Cubs were in the World Series, black people weren't allowed to play baseball. So there's
Was it that long?
Yes. 1945.
So that's what people talk about the Cubs in the World Series as this
incredible
thing,
because
it's actually been that long.
That's the last time they were in the World Series. Right. They haven't won the World Series for 108 years. It's been a century. But yeah, when you put it in like when you frame it like that, it's like, holy shit, really? Okay. Anyway, let's wrap up. Show notes for this episode are going to be found at buildphase.fm/114. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. So you can reach us on Twitter. We're at buildphase, and via email, hosts@buildphase.fm. And as always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are greatly appreciated.
Good. Did it.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right. See ya.
See ya.